All right, welcome to the weekly podcast. Today we've got a really special guest. It's taken us quite a while to set this one up, and the persistence I know is really going to be worth it. Today we're talking with Paul Cassina. Paul is in California. It's lunchtime there. It's a little earlier here, but it's an amazing journey that he's been on, and we're going to learn a little bit about resilience and mindset, and also just facing some really hard times. Paul, welcome to the weekly podcast.
Morning. Thank you for having me.
Morning for me. It's a little bit more sensible over there, but Paul, I've followed you. We made contact via Instagram, and you have an amazing feed. And just give us a quick intro to your journey. Basically, tell us a little bit about you spent some time with the Marines, and then things changed for you when you got back home. Just take us a little bit through that journey.
Yeah, in 2006, when I graduated from high school here in Southern California, I decided to join the Marine Corps, the United States Marine Corps, and did most of my training. I was stationed here in California in September of 2007. I was deployed to Iraq with my unit. I was still in the infantry at the time, having some fun jumping around and driving around the countryside. I came home a little bit, I'd say, adrenaline sinking, can kind of looking after the fun that I once had. And amazingly, it's a hard thing to say, but you get mortared or somebody shoots rockets at you enough. In the beginning, it's absolutely deadly terrifying. But by like the 50th time it's happened, you kind of just become numb to it, where you're like, oh man, like this is like, oh, they're disrupting my sleep, or I can't get food. And like, you literally say things like that, like, oh, why is it every time before chow time, they got to shoot at us? Like they just do it after lunch or after dinner. Like, it's such a weird thing to say. Cause when I was deployed, I was 20 years old, you know, so I hadn't spent much time out of high school, and it was definitely a rude awakening for me, and a great experience at the same time. I loved being able to be in the Marine Corps, and I loved my opportunities in Iraq. And, it's not just what I think a lot of the news and media portrays what has happened in the Middle East. I truly wish that they would have taken more opportunities to talk to the little guys of the war, as I like to think of it, is the guys who are just kind of there, just doing what they're supposed to, but really feeling for the locals and understanding, try to understand what they're having to go through, because you've never experienced anything like that. So when you have treats from home, as far as once in a while when we would get mail, things like Twinkies or candy or stuff like that, you find yourself giving more of that out to them than you having it yourself.
Yeah.
So you get this huge lift of positivity in your own, your own self, like, wow, I'm actually doing something good. You know, you're out here being able to hand out medicine or do dental checks and hand out food and water and treats, and, really get to work with people that are really struggling. And, it does affect you when things go wrong and, you take losses or after engagements with the enemy. And, that I think that's going to eventually take on anybody. But when I came home, I was kind of still seeking after the adrenaline that I had once seen in war. And I wasn't quite behaving the way I should have been. And I was acting very erratic at the time. I don't know. It felt like we had kind of gone through so much, and you feel indestructible. You know, you're at this point, I was 21 years old when by the time, I got home at 20, and then shortly after I turned 21, and I bought myself a brand new street bike. And at the time, and even still today in the United States, we're losing more servicemen to motorcycle accidents than we are in combat, and more injuries, more and more. And I think it starts way back before me, but we weren't really acknowledging post-traumatic stress, or we weren't really looking at people that were taking too many unnecessary risks for just the sake of really being in the wrong mindset, because you want to go out and have stupid fun. I put myself in way more danger than I ever should have. And
what do you think you were looking for at that point? Like, you know the adrenaline come down, but when you just say there, you put yourself in these dangerous positions. Like, what do you think you were looking for? What was the drive or the desire? What were you searching for?
Oh, you never feel more alive than the moment than you are staring death in the face.
Yeah.
Like it doesn't matter if it's somebody shooting rockets or guns or what, you know, from small arms to large, to being able to take a motorcycle and push it to its physical limits and push you to yours, where every part of your brain is saying that, like, no, you should definitely not be doing this because this is way too unsafe.
Yeah.
You don't ever really take a true appreciation for life. I know I didn't, because there were a few situations where I stopped appreciating my own life as well as other lives around us because of, you know, seeing the situations where some people were killed, and realizing that life is very short and it doesn't really matter what you do, that when it's your time, it's your time. So I kind of had the mindset that, like, no matter what I do, I'm going to die or I'm not going to die. That's all that matters.
Yeah.
So when I was involved in my accident on August 24th, 2008, it was a really, really bad accident that I never should have survived. I had an open fracture to my left femur, open fracture to my right tib fib, broken both knees down to my feet, my L3-4-5. I had compression fractures or some compression and with minor fractures. And my left lung had been punctured. My descending aorta in my heart had been actually ripped open, and I had broken a couple ribs. So from my insides to my legs, I was just completely shredded, and not an injury anybody's ever supposed to survive, for sure.
Wow. So how did the accident happen? Where were you?
I was in Palm Springs just riding with some buddies, and I was coming up through this canyon. And for the first time in a long time, we were actually obeying the speed limits because we saw a cop behind us.
Yeah.
And we were like, oh no, we can't afford a ticket. I can't get pulled over by the police. And so as I was coming through this corner, this cop had been behind us for a while, and he was just trying to catch us speeding. And I just came in through a left-hand turn. And August in that area, we have really, really bad dust storms.
Yeah.
And it kicked up a lot of loose sand and debris onto the road, and my buddy in front of me almost went down, and then I hit it a little harder and I ended up going down underneath it. So I washed out and I ended up wrapping my body going feet first into a guardrail post on the side of the road. Wow. So I didn't go off a highway.
So what happened next? Did you stay conscious through the accident, or did you wake up in the hospital? How did the first responders find you?
Well, my buddies who I was with, they immediately started their immediate care. They knew my legs were broken right away and they wouldn't let me sit up. At one point, I kind of popped up just for a moment and I was looking at the bottom of my right boot. I was like seeing the bottom of my right foot laying on my back.
Wow.
And then I looked over and I didn't see my left leg, and it was broken compound 90 degrees to the left, and my buddy was kneeling over each side, so I didn't see my own foot, like,
yeah,
within 8 inches of my head. And I actually remember feeling my femur sticking out of my skin, and I was patting it because it felt like it was on fire. It was just burning, and ungodly burning. So I was reaching down and grabbing my femur, and I was like, what is this? Yeah. And so my buddy wouldn't let me look at it. And finally, I kind of like rolled my head at one point, and I was like, oh shit, that's a bone. And I realized I kept grabbing my own femur sticking out of my skin. So yeah, it was pretty rough. I remembered getting into the helicopter. The probably the most painful part is that they had to put me on a spinal board.
Yeah.
And so the paramedics, even though my legs were broken at different angles, they had to pick my legs up and put them up straight on the stretcher. And so I remember them, having to drag my broken legs only about an inch off of the ground, putting it on the stretcher. And I remember getting into the helicopter. It was a rough ride to the hospital. And then I started to get real cold.
Yeah.
I remember Bird going towards, I remember doctors coming out, and I remember at one point I woke up in an MRI.
Yep.
And then that was about the last thing I remember.
Wow. So this in many ways is where the journey really begins, and this is what really struck me about the, you know, what you shared on Instagram. There's a, honestly, some of the posts there are just quite profound, but the journey really starts here, doesn't it? There's a descent for you. There's a kind of descent into a pretty dark time of life. Now, your wife Monica's going to be there with you through that, but talk us through this next phase, the pain, the recovery, the mindset. You ended up in a pretty dark place, didn't you?
Yeah, I pretty quickly realized that, you know, something had gone horribly wrong. I was in the hospital for 2 months. So this wasn't a quick in and out of the hospital. So I had to lay there painstakingly flat for 5 weeks. I wasn't allowed to sit up for 5 weeks at all. So, I mean, I had a lot of time to sit there and contemplate a whole lot of decisions that that got me to this point in my life. I'm like, oh, I'm 21 and this is where I'm at. Like, oh, no. Mm-hmm. You know, after that, I got released and my legs just didn't work out the same. I had some pretty bad orthopedic surgeons. The wrong size rods were put back in my leg. They had to go back in and adjust and adjust and adjust. And as horrible as the internal organ injuries were, the broken legs were actually not as bad. And the legs should have been fixed properly, but because of bad orthopedic surgeons, that was ultimately what ended up resulting in me having both my legs amputated.
So take us through that. I mean, that you're 21 years of age, you're a highly active young man. What's that experience like for you? I mean, what did you go through realizing you were going to lose your legs?
Well, between the time of my accident and by the time I lost my left leg was about 5 years.
Yeah.
I couldn't find a doctor that agreed with me that being an amputee was going to be better. All the doctors at the time really did think that, as long as the leg is on you, that's the most important thing because, you know, it's just going to be better for you in the long run. And I was in the hospital with a lot of guys that were amputees and a lot of double amputees. And I saw that these amputees were doing a whole lot more than I was.
Yeah.
After like 2 or 3 years of being in the military, being hurt at this point, 3 years after my accident, I'm still getting, you know, surgeries and having operations done. And I'm still watching amputees be way more productive than I was.
Yeah.
So just getting a doctor to agree with me was one of the hardest parts, but they didn't quite understand how much pain I was actually in. Because we were being force-fed so many drugs that by the time I was probably 6 months after my injury, I was such a horrible, god-awful drug addict that the doctors helped make me into. And that's kind of really where a lot of things started to decline from there when I realized that I was a drug addict.
Yeah, and that's... in the posts that you put out, that starts to come through. And I guess most of us have never been through anything like this. You know, you think that medicine's just benevolent and that they're going to get it right all the time. But the pain medication became a huge problem. And what was happening? So was that starting to play out in the relationship with Monica? How were you changing? What was how were the drugs changing you?
Well, when one pain medication wouldn't work, they'd add me to another pain medication. And when that medication stopped working so well, they'd give me a different kind. So at one point, I was on actively taking 23 different medications between helping me sleep, pain, muscles, anxiety. I mean, every list of thing that they could do is that there wasn't any real help. There was only prescribed medications. The doctors, from mental health through the actual physical injuries, nobody was really there. And there was a huge lapse at the time of what doctors really could do or wanted to do. But in the U.S. in 2007, I know it was like nothing anywhere else had ever seen. But in the United States, even today in 2016, we're losing one person to opiates or heroin-related deaths every 15 minutes. Mm. And a lot of these doctors aren't being held accountable for the fact that they shoveled medication into so many of these patients that were, honestly, they were always the victims, because so many people, not just myself, but a lot of people never had the intention of saying like, oh man, I want to be a complete pill addict and ruin everything around me.
Yeah. So what was happening? Like, you know, say for example, what would Monica have noticed? Were you irrational? Were you outbursts of anger? I mean, because you're also dealing with, you know, with PTSD and the loss of the legs and a whole bunch of different things are going on. What are people around you probably noticing?
Monica was, it was probably the worst for her because she was around me all the time, and I don't know how she honestly did stick it out so long. But it was just for the longest time, I felt like I was holding her back, and it was more of a guilty feeling that I felt every day more and more and more and more. And you realize that I have this young, beautiful, smart, intelligent woman that wants to some reason spend every waking minute that she can in a hospital because my doctors can't do something right. And she was spending every minute of her life taking care of what had happened to me. And it made me feel worse and worse and worse that I was 100% reliant on somebody that didn't deserve to have this much pressure and this much put on them at such a young age.
Yeah. Was that something that being in the Corps, like you learned that you had to pull your weight, that you were accountable to the team? Was that hard, like to sort of be dependent?
It was really hard to be that dependent on somebody else. But I think where it also became difficult for me in the transition of not just being hurt, but not being a Marine, is that you have a harder time being around people that don't have the same outlook as you. And that may sound very horrible, but as a Marine, it was an amazing opportunity to know to go to work every day and train as hard as I could every day. Because at some point, if something bad happens, I need this guy to my right or to my left to be able to run out there and save me, or me run out there and save him.
Yeah.
So you develop a kind of love for somebody else that you're like, wow, I would literally lay down my life and die for you so you can come home. And it's because you love that person so much. And then when that military experience is taken away from you, it's the worst breakup you can ever have in your life, because you feel like, how did I emotionally invest so much of myself into strangers? Because we all came from all over the country. And within a year, a lot of people never get to experience that from never knowing somebody. And then a year later saying, I will die for you. There's not a lot of people that will ever live that experience that will say that to somebody. And when that experience is over, it's actually a very hard breakup to have, because you had to trust somebody so much, so deeply. And now that it's over, you don't know if you want to make yourself in a position of being that vulnerable again to saying like, you know, I want to love somebody that much, or I want to take care of somebody that much, or I want somebody to look after me that much. Because you know in the end that it's so heartbreaking if they leave you.
Yeah.
And so if you never know what it's like to, I mean, it's different to have the friends in war, because that's a love I will always have. But unfortunately with my marriage, my wife knows that the love I had for what I did as a Marine is not a love I can ever duplicate again.
Yeah. And so you're lying there, the medication issues are becoming problematic. Monica's sticking by you, but are you able to, I mean, reading some of your posts, it's like you constantly feel you can't give anything back. Why is she staying with me? How did you get through that?
I realized that she is an amazing woman, and she is an amazingly faithful person, and she's been so loving and caring to take care of me for so long. It's not that it was always that I wanted a better life for her, but I always just assumed I couldn't be the one to do it. Yeah. And then one day I realized that I am the one that can do this, and I'm the one that needs to take control of my situation, and I'm the one that needs to get my drug use under control, my alcohol use under control, my attitude under control, my anger in check.
So Paul, take us to the epicenter of that, because that's easy to, you know, people can hear this and it sounds like a relatively straightforward progression, but you went to some very dark places. I mean, when I read your posts, there's quite a strong sense that you almost, you know, you really thought about ending it all. You know, you can't be what she needs. Your identity's constantly being changed through all these different circumstances. What's the leverage point? What's the moment? How do you get from that absolute point of darkness where so much has been taken from you, both physically and in terms of your identity, to being able to go, you know what? I can change. I can be a different person. I can come back from the darkness. What's that dynamic? Many people can't do that. What happened for you?
For me, I have been able to take a very deep look at what other people have to go through. And it's honestly just making sure that you put yourself in a position where you understand that, yes, I am in a hard spot, but let me reach out and find somebody else that may be in a little worse situation than myself. I get my prosthetic legs made at the same place where a U.S. Paralympian named Scout Bassett does. And she told me her story. She's originally from China, and she lost her leg as an infant. She was dropped off at an orphanage. She didn't come to America till she was 8. She never got properly fitted for legs until she was 8 years old. And you know, I sat down and talked to her for maybe an hour, and she talked to me. I just listened to her experience, and all I'm thinking is, like, how can I ever have pity on myself? Like, I didn't lose my leg in a fire as an infant. My parents didn't leave me at a hospital where I was then taken to an orphanage where I had to come to America to finally learn how to do things. Like, you need to get off this little pedestal of thinking that the whole entire world is trying to drown you, because you have no idea how lucky you still are, stupid. And as much as I had physically experienced in my life, while completely under the use of opiates, I felt like nothing else in the world was as wrong as what was being wrong to me. And I think that's one of the worst problems with drug addicts, is because they're the most miserable, god-awful people to be around, because they're so selfish and needy and self-destructive. They're emotionally unavailable. And for the people that have to remain around them, they just have to hear the same bullshit excuse over and over and over. Like, you don't know what this is like. And, oh, I'm trying to do better. And this is this. Like, drug addicts are always great at manipulating people. And they're great at making people feel horrible about things. And I think if, you know, when I was getting into the darkest places of my life, I think that if anyone here has ever been a drug addict or is, you know, in recovery, or even now still an addict themselves, I think the one thing that you realize, you get to a point, what you hate the most is yourself on what you've become, because you look back at your greatest accomplishments. You look back at, holy cow, look at what I've been able to do. And then you realize, like, how weak and pathetic do I look that I keep falling victim to this plastic bottle and these little colored pills? How is it that these little tiny things have everything to do with my life? How can these things control every action and every thought and every reaction that I can possibly have? Like, how could something that weighs nothing control every bit of me? And you learn to hate that so deeply about yourself that's what starts making everybody's life miserable around you, because you hate yourself more than anything else.
So what begins to move you out? Is it as simple as you have this conversation with this other person and you begin to just reconceptualize what's happening? You start to go, hang on, there are people who've actually had it worse. You know, you're saying to yourself, Paul, things have been bad, but you've still got this, you've still got that. Is that the spark that slowly begins to move you out, or was it something else?
It did have a lot to do with that, but I think the one important thing that stuck to me the most was my little brother was a Marine as well. And while he was stationed on the East Coast, one of his good friends committed suicide. And it was shortly before he committed suicide, he asked my brother to come over to his house and just hang out. But my brother was really tired from work. So my brother always carried a heavy guilt of burden after he found out about his friend committing suicide. Mm-hmm. And it's taken a long time for my brother to go and actually seek the counseling that he really, really should have gotten years ago. And I realized at one point when I got to, I didn't care about my wife. I didn't care about my dog. I didn't care about anything that I had. But I got to the point where I walked right to that edge. And I was saying that if I do this, my little brother can't take one more suicide in his life.
Yeah.
And if I do this, my little brother will be following me right behind me.
Yeah.
So in my note, when I said I was tired of hurting people, I was tired of myself hurting. I was tired of living not with just physical pain, but the emotional one of the feeling that I have let so many people down because of my drugs and because of my mistakes. So I was so much more crucial on myself. And instead of learning to try to be more forgiving on myself, instead of just really hating what I had become, because I had made so many mistakes on drugs. And if I consistently felt bad about every mistake I made when I was on drugs, I would never feel better myself. I've gone back and I've apologized to every person I've hurt, and I've had to put my tail between my legs many times and tuck my head and being like, oh man, I'm so sorry. And I have had to do it quite a few times. There's a lot of humbleness in recovery, and there's even more, you know, I don't want to call it shame, but when you ask for forgiveness from somebody, and you just feel like this heavy burden is lifted off.
Yeah.
Because you finally like, okay, I'm sorry that I admitted 100% why I was acting like a piece of garbage to you, like why I couldn't have treated you any better. I told many people that, and explained like why I felt like I was such a scumbag. And when you apologize for it, they can forgive you.
Yeah.
Or they can remember what you were, but you can really do for yourself is you can't control how they feel about you. You can only control yourself on how you feel about yeah. yourself. If they want to still be angry at me, by all means, they have that right. I know I was god awful to so many people when I was just constantly abusing drugs. I mean, it was 7.5 years of constantly abusing opiates.
Yeah.
So that's 7.5 years of destroying relationships and friendships. So if none of those people came back, I completely understood why, but the ones that stayed around, I appreciated it so much because I was man enough to go up to every single one of them and say, that wasn't who I was. That was because I was on drugs and I'm not going to go back to that.
Yeah.
They're not going to judge me and say like, you know, like you were an asshole. Like if I can go up to them and being like, I'm sorry, I was an asshole. And I was probably much worse than that. You know, I don't want to make it to, I don't want to make it to where I feel like I'm indebted to them, but they at least know that I'm an adult and say, I'm sorry, I screwed up.
Yeah.
And as an adult, I accept what I did. And if that means our friendship is over, then so be it. So because Paul, that was my...
So many men, you know, you've just brought up so much in that. I mean, the fact that with your younger brother, the real leverage point there is love. It's like, you may not have put the language on it, but you cared about him enough that you knew that if you took that step, then he's at risk too. The power of forgiveness, you know, the ability to step up and go, I did this. And I for many of us as men, there's a fear of that vulnerability and fragility that men will spend their entire lives running, either through performance or money or, you know, booze or drugs, avoiding this kind of openness and pain. How were you able to do it? Why not keep running? Why not descend more into the drugs? Why not stay arrogant and say, screw you all, you don't know what I've been through? Why change?
I grew up as well as my brother did. We grew up in a pretty loveless house. I can honestly tell you my entire life, we from our parents, we never heard like "I love you," "good job," or anything like that. It was always negative discipline, no matter what. Like, if you did something good, that was not acknowledged, but when you did something bad, that was the only thing acknowledged.
Yeah.
So when you grow up in an emotionally empty house where your dad is emotionally, like, my dad blamed us for him being an alcoholic for most of our lives.
Yeah.
Like, he literally said, "I only drink because I have you guys here."
Oh, yeah.
So you start realizing that, you know, you start being around emotionally empty people, you know, that you realize that I actually realized when I was looking at my dad, like, you were so god awful miserable and you hate everybody in the world that I honestly don't care how much money you have. I want nothing to be like you. And I had talked to my parents and I had apologized to my parents about for some of my behavior while I was on drugs. And the only thing I do regret apologizing to my parents about was apologizing to them that I had post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yeah.
I told them that I didn't know why I came home from Iraq different. And I know, and this goes for everybody. I think you should never apologize to any childhood or any adulthood trauma. I think if you're changed by some sort of trauma in your life, never by any means should you never have to justify that to anybody else.
Yeah.
If you don't want going out in crowds because of a bad experience, or if you don't want to go out at night because of a bad experience, or you don't like driving because of a bad experience, by all means, it's for your life to live.
Yeah.
And it's only for you to decide how you want to live it. So I that's the biggest thing that I've learned, is never apologize for what's wrong with you. Just apologize for what you can do. And for me, seeing my parents being so emotionally empty to my brother and I for most of our lives, I realized that that's not a cycle in life that I want to continue doing. I don't want my wife to end up being treated the same way my mom was treated her entire marriage. And it's a really depressing way to look at it, to think that somebody that, you know, your spouse is the person that you're supposed to like think like, "Oh my God, I'm so excited to see you every day." To think that like my mom and dad don't have that marriage, is that's just heartbreaking.
Yeah.
Because the way I look and feel about my wife, I sometimes honestly, like, I still like sometimes how I get giddy or nervous with her. it's really weird because we've been together for we've been together almost 8 years.
Yeah.
So, I mean, so for me, I she can still turn my head more than anything else.
Wow.
And, understanding how appreciative I am of everything that she sacrificed. Like, this is no joke. She's probably going to kill me if she ever finds this out. But one day, like, no joke, like, we had sex and like, literally like 20 minutes later, like, the joke here in America is like, hey, you know, once you have sex, get out of bed and, you know, she's going to go make me a sandwich.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I literally got up. Like, I got dressed, I took care of everything, and then I started making lunch. Like, my wife has sex with me, and I go make lunch? Like, come on.
there's a beautiful post that you did where you talked about, you know, just holding hands. You said, that Monica was just enjoyed that so much, and you hadn't been able to even do that because you'd either been in so much pain or just so distant, but the experience of just holding hands together, it was quite a beautiful post.
Yeah, it came from years of being stuck in a wheelchair or crutches or a cane or just not having enough stability to be able to walk.
Yeah.
And she was never able to hold my hand and walk. So now, as a double amputee, I'm able to scoot around and walk around all over, and I get to have a lot more fun. So when we get to go out and do things, you know, I can actually hold my wife's hand.
Yeah.
When we're out and about walking. And it's such a weird thing to kind of picture in someone's head, because we had lived together. We had bought a house together. We had been married, had a dog. We had had all this stuff together, but we had never actually walked and held hands for more than 1 minute in all that time.
Oh, yeah.
So yeah, we can sit down, but we've actually never walked more than 1 minute and ever held hands. So when you start realizing that when you have importances like that in your life,
yeah,
not just with not just with my marriage, but like how I'm physically doing.
Yeah.
It makes it all the more easier to just tell my friends, like, again, like, I'm sorry for being such a screw up when I was on drugs, but this is what is important to me.
Yeah.
And so if I apologize to somebody and they don't forgive me, or they're just like, whatever, peace out, I don't really need their acknowledgement.
Yeah.
I want my wife to know that I'm doing better for her.
Yeah.
I went to other people to apologize, to clear it off my chest, and to make them know that I acknowledge the fact that I hurt them in some way.
So tell me,
if they don't want to be friends, it's okay.
So tell me, as a person of faith, how did you experience sort of God in all this? I mean, a lot of people with a more juvenile perspective are like, you know, how could God let this happen? I mean, how do you, what's the spiritual component of your journey? You know, how does a loving God let you get injured? How does a loving God let you become an addict? I mean, how as a man of faith, how have you experienced this spiritually?
It took quite a beating on me, to be honest.
Yeah.
Because you start asking yourself more and more over and over again, like, what did I do to deserve this? And that's the biggest question that it always comes through. And then, you know, you always ask, like, well, why, how could God do this to me? And how could God do this and this and this? And then, you know, even in this interview here, it's always easy for me to see. And I understand sometimes it wasn't easy for me to see in the past, but the fact that I'm able to come out of what I did, where I literally had a gun in my mouth several times, I had written a note and I knew a location where I was going to go do stuff. When I've been that far down and where I'm at now, where I can share my story on the other side of the world, and hopefully some other kid somewhere else or somebody in Australia or anywhere in the world has a feeling the same way I did of being like, yeah, when I was there, this is what I felt like. But with my faith, you know, even today in church, one of the things they talked about is that don't point out, I'm paraphrasing, but don't, you know, point out if your neighbor has a small issue while you have plenty yourself that are unresolved. Yeah. Don't look at your brother for the sawdust in his eye when you have a plank in yours. Remove your plank before you look at his you know, sawdust in his eye.
Yeah.
And I think that's a situation where a lot of us, I don't want to speak worldwide, but I definitely understand American logic, that it's so much easier for us to sit there and tell everybody else what they're doing wrong and why they're doing it wrong and what is wrong about it, instead of saying, you know, maybe I've got some things in my life that I should try to adjust or take care of or look into.
Yeah.
Or, you know, try to improve on my own before I sit here and berate somebody else about something that I personally don't like about them.
Yeah. So give us the big learnings, you know, we begin to wrap up now and let's look at this whole journey. You know, aspects of your childhood that have been, you know, challenging in the home situation, the brotherhood in the core, and then being separated from that, the injuries, the descent into addiction, and suicide, and all of that darkness, and where you are now. What have you learned about life? What are the big takeaways that you've got that anybody could apply to their life? Things that you can teach us through your pain, through the hardship. What have been the big learnings for you?
I would truly hope that every person takes the opportunity to really look at life for what it is and how beautiful it can be. I think enough people are so caught up in what we're doing now and what needs to be done for this and this and this, that we don't spend a lot of time really enjoying some of the greatest things that we have in our lives. And it's really the people that are right next to us. The people that we have next to us, or should be, what making our time, our short time on this earth, all the more pleasant, because we never know when our opportunity is going to be over. My wife leaves every day to go to work. I drive to San Diego. I drive 75 miles down to San Diego 3 to 4 times a week. At any given time, my wife or I could be taken in a car accident. And I acknowledge that's always a probability. So why would I ever want to make any moment before I get in my car as stressed as I can when something as simple as a car accident could end my life, or I could never see my spouse or significant other again. Don't leave an opportunity for you to leave someone with a bad taste in their mouth. And I think for anybody out there who, I hopefully this reaches anybody who is working with or knows somebody who's dealing with a substance abuse issue, I want to personally say that I know that it's a miserable thing and it's making everybody miserable. But the person they are now because they're an addict isn't who they really are. They have been changed by something that they don't understand or they don't know.
Yeah.
Being on drugs is not what somebody wants to do forever. And as frustrating as it may be, just never give up on them. Most importantly, they need the love more than any time else, I think, when they're an addict.
So, and that's come through in different ways in so much of what you've shared. Love, which when I'm, you know, giving seminars, I say to people, the problem we have with love is that it's the one word to describe our most important relationships on the planet, and it's the same word we use to describe our relationship with pizza. but listening to you, you know, I was touched when you talked about the point of walking away from suicide was the realization of the impact on your brother, and behind that is the fact that you love the guy. The marriage, you know, your relationship with Monica. When I asked you about the big learnings, you talk about really being present to the people closest to you and appreciating them, which is because you love them. I mean, that seems to be a really central thing. You talk about people who are dealing with addiction and sticking by them because love is central. It's listening to you, that's such a powerful thing. What have you learned about love in this whole process?
I think when people who are addicts, they're the reason why a lot of us are addicts is because we're missing something in our life. And I generally believe that that one genuine thing is true love. If it's denying who you should be with or who you want to impress, you know, if it's from your parents not acknowledging you, or if it's from a spouse not acknowledging you, or your work not acknowledging you, whatever the case may be, it's a fact that they're just plain missing something.
Yeah.
And when you happen to spend more time with people that you love, you have a real, I truly believe the most authentic relationship you can have is being so face to face with someone. And I do unfortunately believe that that's the huge part of the problem with social media bullying. Yeah. Is because they're sitting there stuck being private, wanting to be mean to other people. But that's not really in our nature who we want to be. We want to experience love and we want to experience sharing something with somebody. But at the same time, we also have this god-awful fear of dread of rejection and loss. And that's probably one of the hardest things to do. And as far as addicts go, that's why addicts, it's always easier with addicts and drugs and any other substance, because they know no matter what, that substance will always be there to care for them and judge them and keep them warm and never tell them that they're wrong or say that they're doing something bad, because the drugs will just always be there for you. And that's why people have a hard time leaving them.
So looking back over this, security's been triggered.
You're okay, buddy. Baxter, come here. Sorry, somebody just rang the doorbell. Baxter,
no, that's all good.
Sorry about that.
No, that's good. So let's finish up. In the great history of your life, when you look back, you know, why do you think you were given this experience?
Oh my God. Baxter! I apologize.
You're all good.
I think the ultimate experience was for me to be able to understand that I was able to have a second life and a better life from where I came from.
Yep.
And when I have children, offer them a better life than from what I have, because it's going to give me the chance to not complete this or, you know, redo the cycle that was shown to me, you know, being able to show your kids that you can love them, show your kids that you can appreciate them and really truly value your kids for what they are. and, you know, instead of blaming them for why you're an addict.
Yeah.
So when you, you know, I do believe that I'm here for the better purpose of not just Monica's world, but mine, but I want kids, and I've had an opportunity to tell my story quite a few times to people.
Yeah.
And, all I really, really truly hope for, all I truly hope for is that maybe at some point, Esther, is that somebody hears this and maybe one person in a crowd will say, I know what he's going through, or it'll be somebody in the crowd saying like, well, I don't want to give up on my brother, sister, mom, dad, husband, wife, whatever it may be, if they're an addict.
Yeah.
Like, this guy's literally living proof. He's telling me that like he had a gun in his mouth because of how bad he felt about himself. And all he said is that he just needed some positive love. Like, that's the easiest thing I can do.
Yeah.
It's easy to get frustrated and angry and walk away and scream and yell. But the hardest thing to do is love somebody that doesn't love themselves.
Yeah.
And I think that's the biggest key that I think most people need to really understand while working with addicts is they don't love themselves. The addict does not like themselves in the way they are before being a drug addict.
Yeah.
And even as a drug addict.
So with everything that you've been through, this is always a hard question for people. Try and finish this sentence if you can. The two most important things in life are?
Love and family. Yeah. I really do think that that's the most important thing, because I think with your family, you, as long as you know what's best for you, you're going to do what's best for them, and you want to set the best example for everyone around you.
Yeah, and I've picked that up listening to you. Like, there's a desire in you to be someone for Monica, and it comes through in your posts, and you can see this kind of moment where you go, well, I can be a drug addict and I can hide in this stuff, but there's almost like you, at some point you went, I can really be someone for her. And the other thing, I mean, love and family, the other thing that's come through in your interview is just the power of forgiveness, that you've been able to look into your family experience, that you've been able to, you know, ask for forgiveness as well. Forgiveness seems to be really powerful for you as well.
I think it has to be for anybody in life who walks around with a code of anger, because you walk around angry enough long enough that you realize that you're wasting so much of your life away and missing all the beautiful opportunities that you have.
Yeah.
If you, you can forgive somebody and say like, all right, now I just don't want to see you ever again.
Yeah.
Just don't affiliate yourself. But at the same time, understand that only put as much effort into yourself, into being happy, as you think somebody else would want for themselves.
Yeah.
So if you're surrounded by other people in life that don't want you to be happy, don't be around them.
Yeah.
If you are around people that don't want you to be the best you can possibly be, don't be around them.
Yeah.
Make sure that you hang around people that want to bring you up, and make sure you hang around people that you want to bring up.
Yeah.
Everybody struggles in life, and that's just a fact. And sometimes the hardest part about struggling is the restart, hitting the restart button, because we're afraid to do it. Like, we've made too many commitments into being a screw up.
Yeah.
But it's never too late. I'm definitely a testament to that.
You are. And there's a, I don't know if you can hear it, but there's a hope in your voice. There's a tone in your voice. What does the future hold for you? What's on the horizon? What are you going to do next?
Right now we're having some house remodeling projects done, and it'll be done maybe in 2 months or so.
Yeah.
We're maybe by the end of the year, we're looking at getting a new dog.
Yeah.
And then at that point, where my wife and I are talking about starting a family.
Woohoo.
And with me too, with like the word hope, is that I always know that there's going to be a brighter day for me.
Yeah.
And I know this is going to, this is not me complaining by any means, but my wife and I planned for a vacation in Haiti. We were supposed to leave next week, but
yeah,
we planned this vacation like about 9-10 months ago.
Yeah.
And obviously for me, I get to live and wake up to an experience like this, where I still get to realize that, wow, I have no legs. Okay. I have to go to doctors. All right. But I'm still alive and I'm still here. And just because I worked real hard to finally get a vacation for the year, you know, I realize that there's still a lot of bigger problems in this world that I can't grasp. I don't know what those people are going through in Haiti. Yeah. So for me, the idea that, you know, my vacation is over means absolutely nothing for me. Like, I feel awful for what's happening to the people in Haiti. And I think if we had more people with more of an understanding like that, instead of saying like, why am I the victim? You know, because a lot of people could have this like, oh, dang, like the storm ruined my vacation. Yeah. Like the storm ruined people's lives.
Yeah, that's right.
And so always making sure you try to stay as mindful about everything as you can, just because there are so many sensitive things in this world that we kind of just completely look past.
Yeah.
Like nobody likes going to the airport. Everybody hates how the security goes. It's always a mess and they lose your luggage.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you're like, well, I get to go to a beautiful destination, or I get to go somewhere where somebody in the United States will never get to go to.
Yeah.
Like me, I get to live really close to the Pacific Ocean. I live about an hour from the ocean.
Yeah.
So for me, I know there are kids in this country and there are people in this country that will never even see the ocean.
See the ocean, yeah.
Tony
Robbins used to say that, you know, so many people's biggest problem is what kind of sauce to put on their taco.
He's a very intelligent man. I did watch one of his things.
Yeah.
And it really made me think a whole lot, because he said, if you're gonna blame somebody, blame them for everything.
Yeah.
And when I started really thinking about it, it was like, I do want to blame my parents for a whole lot, but in the end, I should also blame them for making me want to be sober, because I know what it was like growing up with an addict as a father, and I know that's a horrible thing to do.
Yep.
So thank you for showing me that you being an addict is the worst way to raise children. Yeah. Thank you for showing me how you should never treat children.
Sure.
Thank you for showing me that what you did was not acceptable.
Yeah. Yeah, and on blame, I often teach in seminars, I say, well, you know, when you blame, I say to people, you know what? You're right. You're probably completely correct. When you blame somebody, I'm going to say, if we talk to you, you're probably right. It is their fault. And then there's two magical words when I say, you know, now what? You know, once you've blamed, it's like, okay, you're blamed. And then what's different? You know, nothing. Like, you still have to get on with the business of choosing and living and getting on with life. So, Paul, thank you so much for being on the weekly podcast. There is a huge amount in this. I want people to listen to it a couple of times. I'm going to send people to your Instagram feed, because that narrates so much of your journey, and you write quite beautifully and vulnerably about your experience. So I'm going to get people to go there. But thank you so much for making the time. Thank you for your courage. I don't know if that's hard to hear, but you've been to a very dark place and somewhere... you know, in partnership with Monica and with what God was doing in your life, you were able to make a choice to fight for yourself, to fight for her, to fight for others. You've given us a lot, because you're right. Somebody will hear this globally. This audience is a big audience now. And so thank you for your courage, and thanks for making the time.
I definitely appreciate everything that you do and allowing me to tell my story. And I really do look at all I've had to go through, and all I can really hope is that if my story is heard and it helps one person, then all this misery was worth it. And I know that sounds cliche, but it's the absolute truth. I don't want somebody to get down into a hole as dark as I was. I don't want somebody to end up feeling the same way I did, or thinking that's the only way out. I've been there and it's miserable, and I would do anything to try to stop anybody, even strangers, from doing it, because I would never want somebody to ever feel that way again.
Fantastic.
The way I felt was not the way any human should ever feel. And I think it's just about every person's civil duty to make sure that they can help their other man and just be a good person. Like, that's all we have to do. Just be a good person.
Yeah, 100%. Paul, thanks so much for your time. Have a great day.
Thank you very much. Take it easy.
Well, there you go. I hope you got as much out of listening to that as I did. Where do we start? So many times in life, difficult things happen, things that we may never have wished, but it's the capacity to choose our response that makes all the difference. I hope you found in Paul's story that even though he's confronted with not only the loss of his legs, but the challenge of addiction. He found ways and reasons to press on and really start to build something magnificent out of his life. I hope you can take some encouragement from that, whatever you're facing in life. If you enjoyed this podcast, I'd love you to grab the link, post it on your social media feeds, share it with other people. I'd love to see the message of Paul's experience shared more and more widely. So if you're not a regular listener, make sure you use one of the boxes or the sign up spaces anywhere you're hearing this. Come and follow us on social media, on Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat. We'd love to hear from you. But quite simply from me, what a privilege to do that interview, and I really hope it's going to make a difference in your life. I'm Jonathan Doyle. I'll speak with you again very soon.